You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's a continuation of Son of a Preacher Man by Gabriel Sherman. Becky, meanwhile, felt the thrill of a new opportunity in her role as Liberty's First Lady. For 20 years, she'd been a stay-at-home mother, raising three children. I would get up and watch Live with Regis and Kathy Lee. That was my adult interaction, basically. The rest of the day, I'd wash clothes and cook, she recalled. Becky's stay-at-home life endeared her to her conservative mother-in-law. Mom grew to love her when she saw what a great wife and mother she became, Jerry said. But as the wife of Liberty's new president, Becky had a new professional identity and responsibilities. It motivated her to get a makeover. She hired a personal trainer and bought a new wardrobe. Still, Becky felt lonely and isolated at home. Jerry was working all the time, and their marriage suffered. It was even more confusing for Becky when she walked around Liberty's campus and noticed boys noticing her. They would give me attention that I'd never gotten before, Becky said. In February 2012, Becky turned 45. She and Jerry had been married for 25 years. They had three children between the ages of 12 and 23. She couldn't suppress the nagging feeling that, having wed young, she had missed an entire chapter of adulthood. I didn't have a college life, she said, as she recalled the circumstances that led to what she called the biggest regret I've ever had. The story of an affair is a competition of narratives. Sometimes facts overlap, but just as often they diverge. It all depends on who's doing the retelling. In media interviews, Giancarlo Granda said he first had sex with Becky while Jerry watched the day they met at the Fontainebleau Hotel pool in Miami Beach in March 2012. It was the beginning, Granda has said, of a seven-year psychodrama that culminated in Jerry's resignation. In early January, when I sought out Granda with a list of fact-checking queries for this story and the opportunity to present his version of events, he made clear that his differed significantly from the Falwells. Ha ha, oh man, it's an alternate reality in that email list, he responded, but declined to comment further, saying he had a book deal with HarperCollins and a forthcoming streaming documentary to promote. I can assure you that everything will be answered in the book and Hulu documentary, he texted me. Apart from his initial statement denying Granda's claims, Jerry said nothing about the scandal, even after it cost him his job and reputation. I had been talking with Jerry and Becky for several months when they agreed to tell their side of the story. Jerry said the first time he learned of the affair was 8 months after he and Becky met Granda. In December 2012, Becky seemed distant and melancholic for reasons Jerry couldn't figure out. I would see her crying around the house, Jerry recalled. A few days after Christmas, Jerry walked in on Becky in tears in their bedroom. He asked why she was sad. "Because of the trouble I've made for you," Becky said. Jerry remembered there was a long pause. Then Becky told him she was cheating on him. Jerry had to suppress the urge to yell. Their daughter, Caroline, 12 at the time, was asleep down the hall. "With who?" Jerry seethed. "Giancarlo," Becky said. "Giancarlo?" Jerry's mind flashed back to March. Granda was the 20-year-old pool boy they met at the Fontainebleau. It was hardly a wild vacation. They had taken their three kids to Miami with two other Lynchburg families. The group included Jerry's dentist, a devout evangelical, and a Bible study teacher from church. One afternoon at the pool, Granda struck up a conversation with Jerry and Becky while taking their food order. Granda mentioned he was working to pay for courses at Florida International University. Jerry thought Granda seemed like an ambitious college kid and wished him luck. According to Becky, Granda slipped her his cell phone number. The next day, she invited him up to see the view from their room. She said Jerry was present when Granda visited and nothing sexual happened. Jerry said he didn't know then that Becky and Granda began speaking constantly. "I know it's very strange," Becky said, "but with Jerry working all the time, I had someone I could talk to. At first, the dynamic was maternal. We talked about everything. I would talk about Liberty stuff and the kids," Becky recalled. "But over time, the text became flirtatious. 'Good morning, beautiful,' Granda would text her. 'Right now, I am just missing you like crazy,' Becky would text back. Becky said she felt a thrill every time she checked her phone. It's that dopamine rush. All of a sudden, this handsome young fella starts texting you and giving you attention, and you're like, 'Wow, this is kind of nice,' she recalled. 'I didn't think he was that good looking,' Jerry told me. In April 2012, a month after meeting Granda, Jerry and Becky vacationed at Chica Lodge, a luxury resort in Islamadora, about 90 minutes south of Miami. This time, their kids weren't there. Becky told Jerry that the young guy who worked at the Fontainebleau pool wanted to drive down and pitch Jerry a business idea. Jerry said it didn't seem all that strange. He was happy to help Granda, the son of first-generation Cuban and Mexican immigrants. Over dinner, Granda told Jerry he wanted to start an organization to treat video game addiction. Granda explained he was a recovering gaming addict. In high school, the habit had cost Granda his place on the varsity baseball team. Jerry passed on the idea. "It didn't make sense to me," Jerry recalled. He told Granda he was busy running Liberty, but he did some real estate deals on the side. "I like to walk on my assets," Jerry said. "So if Granda knew about a property investment in Miami, Jerry might be open to it." A couple of months later, Granda told Jerry they should get into the hotel business together. Granda said his friend from high school, Jesus Fernandez Jr., had experience in the field. According to court documents, Fernandez previously worked at the Bikini Hostel in South Beach, and Fernandez's girlfriend was, at the time, the general manager there. Fernandez's father, Jesus Fernandez Sr., worked in Miami real estate. He knew about another hostel coming on the market. Granda said Jerry should buy it. Granda would manage it in exchange for a 24% ownership stake. He promised he would work 24/7, Jerry said. "We thought we'd be 1,000 miles away, and he would be a good person to keep an eye on the business." That summer, Jerry and Becky flew to Miami a few times to scout properties. They liked the idea of owning a business in Florida. It would give them a reason to spend time at the beach, where they felt free from prying eyes in Lynchburg. "Miami was a nice place to get away and feel like another country," Jerry told me. "I thought, nobody knows us." Becky added, "I can have a drink by the pool. We just felt at home." Becky said that while Jerry was looking at real estate one day, she and Granda had sex for the first time. "I relived what I thought college would be, going to clubs, dancing, and all the stuff I couldn't do back home," Becky said. They swapped love songs over text. Becky said Granda sent her Little Things by One Direction and Sideways by Citizen Cope. Around this time, she started signing her text to Granda, "I love you." When Granda called, Becky snuck off to talk. Her unexplained absences became a running joke in the Falwell family. Her kids printed T-shirts that read, "Where's Becky?" In August 2012, Jerry made a $4.6 million offer on a two-story commercial property on the scruffier east side of Miami Beach. The building housed a liquor store, an Italian restaurant, and a 120-bed hostel where dorm rooms went for $20 per night. TripAdvisor described the hostel's theme as party tropical. A sign on the front door stated, "No soliciting, fundraising, politics, salesmen, religion." Now, well before this point, you might have wondered why Jerry and Becky would buy a seedy hostel with a pool attendant they had known for only a few months. Granda said it was because they were a throuple. Again, the Falwells deny this. But take the sex out, and it still shows questionable business sense on Jerry's part to invest millions in an idea hatched by a college kid. One explanation for this catastrophe, in judgment, is that Jerry and Becky didn't have many close friends who weren't ultra-religious. In Miami, they were refugees from the evangelical world and were starting their social lives from scratch. Of course, having an affair and doing business with a pool attendant the same age as their kids crossed all kinds of boundaries that should have been glaringly obvious to everyone involved. Becky said she simply lost control. "This new life was so different for me." In September, the wall that divided the Falwells' double life came down. Jerry and Becky bought Granda plane tickets to fly to Lynchburg for a speech Trump was giving at Liberty during the peak of Trump's racist birtherism campaign. An infamous photo from the event shows Granda shaking Trump's hand backstage as a smiling Jerry looks on. 3 months later, Becky told Jerry about the affair. It all might have ended there. Becky confessed before the hostel deal closed. Jerry and Becky could have taken a loss on the deposit, cut ties with Granda, and walked away. But Jerry insisted it was too late to cancel the deal. He went ahead and invested $1.8 million. "Once it starts, it's like you can't get out of it," Becky said. The Falwells closed on the hostel in February 2013, only a month and a half after Becky told Jerry she was sleeping with Granda. Becky told Granda that Jerry knew about them. "Giancarlo was very worried Jerry or my boys would beat him up," Becky said. Granda declined to comment. Becky said Granda shouldn't be scared. Everyone would try to make the awkward arrangement work. Granda apologized to Jerry the next time they were all together. He said, "I hope you're okay." "And I said, I'm dealing with it," Jerry recalled. "The only way I could do it was to detach. I let it go on. I'm partly to blame." But later, the affair inspired Jerry to get in shape to win Becky back. "I was thinking maybe I was the reason she was lonely, because I wasn't taking care of myself," he said. Jerry hired a trainer. He lifted weights and took testosterone supplements. Jerry attributed a lot of the incendiary things he later did to side effects of the hormones. "The testosterone made me more combative," he said. The affair continued for another year. Over that summer, Jerry and Becky went to Miami and checked into the Loews Hotel. Jerry discovered that Becky booked a second room at the Gale Hotel for her and Granda. "I paid cash," Becky recalled. Jerry confronted them outside the room. "It was obvious what they were doing," he said. On another trip to Miami in the fall of 2013, Jerry said he walked into his hotel room to get his laptop and found Becky and Granda having sex. "It was traumatizing," he said. In May 2014, Granda attended the wedding of Jerry and Becky's oldest son, Trey. Becky said she stopped having sex with Granda in 2014 because by then Granda had a serious girlfriend. "I felt guilty about it. I didn't want to keep it up," she said. This is the part of the story where things turn to something more like a Coen Brothers farce. Enter the two Jesuses. In the summer of 2014, Jerry says he received an email from a Miami lawyer representing Granda's high school friend, Jesus Fernandez Jr., and his father, Jesus Sr., who who said Jerry promised them a cut of the hostel deal for advising Jerry and Grenda on it. Jerry denied he made any such assurances. Talks stalemated. In 2014, the Fernandezes sued Jerry, Becky, and Grenda in a Miami court, claiming fraud and breach of contract. Jerry and Becky panicked that the lawsuit would attract media attention. Jerry would wake up every morning and worry that my affair would come out. Both of us did. It's just horrible to have that over you, Becky told me in the kitchen, holding back tears. What Becky hadn't told Jerry was that she and Grenda had made sex tapes together in a Miami hotel room. I had a big Canon camera. A couple of times I put it on the dresser and Giancarlo agreed to it, Becky told me. Grenda did not comment on this specific detail. Jerry's and Becky's fears only intensified. That fall, Becky's lawyers were made aware that topless pictures of her were circulating among people who were party to the suit. The photo showed Becky posing on a tractor at the Falwells farm. Jerry told me he had taken the mirrors earlier on his phone. We were just playing around, he said. Luckily for Jerry, he was friends with the guy you call when someone has pictures of your half-naked wife, Trump's fixer, Michael Cohen. Jerry and Becky first met Cohen in the spring of 2011 when Cohen, then advising Trump on a potential presidential run in 2012, invited the Falwells to a private meeting with the evangelical leaders at Trump Tower. In the hallway afterward, Jerry and Becky mentioned to Cohen they were staying an extra day in New York because their 12-year-old daughter, Caroline, was trying to get tickets to see Justin Bieber perform live on the Today Show. Cohen got them in. We're friends for life, Jerry told Cohen. After learning of the topless photos, Cohen says he began working the phone on Jerry's behalf, threatening to involve the FBI if necessary. According to him, the parties came to an understanding. The photos never saw the light of day. The Fernandezes and their current lawyer did not respond to requests for comment. The suit ended with a settlement. Jerry was beyond relieved. There it was, my second chit with the Falwells, Cohen later wrote in his memoir. In good time, I would call in this favor, not for me, but for Trump, at a crucial moment on his journey to the presidency. It's hard to remember now, but early in the 2016 Republican primary, Ted Cruz was the leading evangelical candidate. A January 2016 Des Moines Register poll showed Cruz with a 10-point lead in Iowa and with three times more evangelical support than Trump. Cruz was a fervent evangelical himself and the son of a pastor. Cruz announced his presidential run at Liberty in March 2015. Most people assumed that if Jerry endorsed a candidate in the primary, it would be Cruz. The Cruz campaign had even prepared a press release in anticipation. But 5 days before the Iowa caucuses, Jerry rocked the political world when he endorsed Trump. Jerry was the first major evangelical leader to throw in with Trump, which dealt a terminal blow to Cruz's campaign. When the media later reported that Cohen kept nude pictures of Becky out of the press, Jerry's endorsement looked to some like a quid pro quo. Cohen denies this, and Jerry said that wasn't the case at all. Michael never blackmailed me. He's a good friend. We saw Michael 2 days before he went to prison. He calls us family. Cohen didn't need to coerce the endorsement because Jerry was already supporting Trump behind the scenes and echoing his rhetoric. 3 days after the December 2, 2015 mass shooting in San Bernardino, California, Jerry brought a .25 caliber pistol on stage at an all-school assembly. If more good people had concealed carry permits, then we could end those Muslims before they walked in, he said. Jerry also let Liberty's IT chief, John Gager, do consulting for the Trump campaign. According to the Wall Street Journal, Gager manipulated online polls on the Drudge Report and CNBC.com to boost Trump's popularity. Jerry said he was unaware of the specifics of Gager's work. Cohen reportedly paid Gager $12,000 in cash, stuffed in a blue Walmart bag. Gager confirmed this account to the Wall Street Journal, but declined to comment further when I reached him. Cohen told the paper he paid him with a check. Jerry told me he supported Trump because he was a real estate developer and a populist. But I also couldn't help but see the Trump endorsement as a continuation of Jerry's rebellion against evangelical pieties. Trump drove many evangelicals crazy, including Jerry's Ted Cruz supporting younger brother, Jonathan. In October 2015, Jerry's mother, Maycel, died, which severed one of the last bonds tying Jerry and Jonathan together. Jerry endorsed Trump 2 months later. Jerry not only endorsed Trump, he lavished him with cringeworthy praise. "Trump reminds me so much of my father," Jerry told Fox News in December 2015. "In my opinion, Donald Trump lives a life of loving and helping others as Jesus taught," Jerry said when he introduced Trump on stage at Liberty shortly before the Iowa caucuses. Trump then mangled a Bible verse citing 2 Corinthians instead of 2 Corinthians. Jerry even defended Trump when almost no one else would. After the Access Hollywood tape leaked in October 2016, Jerry told a radio interviewer, "We're never going to have a perfect candidate unless Jesus Christ is on the ballot." It provided cover for evangelicals to excuse Trump's utter lack of decency or morals. After that, Steve Bannon called me and said, "You won the election for us," Jerry recalled. Jerry says Trump rewarded his fealty with an offer to serve in his cabinet as education secretary. Jerry recalled the meeting at Trump Tower with Trump, Bannon, and Ivanka Trump. Ivanka was like, "Come on, dude, you gotta do it." Jerry declined, though, because he said it would have involved a pay cut from his $800,000 a year Liberty job. Still, Jerry continued to act as if he were a member of the administration. He and Becky visited the White House and got a private tour of the Lincoln bedroom from Trump and Melania. Jerry showed up often on Fox News to flack for Trump. "He does not have a racist bone in his body," Jerry said after Charlottesville. "The fake news should listen to what he had to say. Thanks, Jerry," Trump tweeted afterward. Not even Trump's disastrous handling of the COVID-19 pandemic could shake Jerry's loyalty. Jerry told Fox and Friends that Democrats and the media were hyping the virus to bring Trump down. If you think of Jerry's downfall as a plane crash, then his Trump endorsement was the fatal error in the decision chain. From that moment, disaster was inevitable. "Trump was the reason they came after me as hard as they did," Jerry said. At Liberty, opposition to Jerry mounted slowly at first. Faculty aren't offered tenure, and professors feared for their jobs if they spoke out. Students followed a culture of acquiescence. "Christians, like slaves and soldiers, ask no questions," Jerry Falwell Sr. once preached. But after the Access Hollywood tape leaked, a group called Liberty United Against Trump released an open letter signed by 2,000 students. "Because our president has led the world to believe that Liberty University supports Donald Trump, we students must take it upon ourselves to make clear that Donald Trump is absolutely opposed to what we believe," the letter stated. In March 2016, Mark DeMoss, by then a faith-based PR guru and chairman of Liberty's board, criticized Jerry during an interview with the Washington Post. "The bullying tactics of personal insult have no defense, and certainly not for anyone who claims to be a follower of Christ," DeMoss told the paper. DeMoss's resignation came 2 months later and inspired others. Liberty alumni organized a Return Your Diploma Facebook group to protest Jerry's defense of Trump's Charlottesville remark about there being very fine people on both sides. 700 graduates signed up. But to really take Jerry down, his detractors needed to do more than just highlight Jerry's Trump sycophancy. In the winter of 2017, an anonymous source tipped off the freelance journalist Brandon Ambrosino. Why does Falwell need to own an LGBT-friendly hostel, the source emailed. Ambrosino was a Liberty alumnus and was well-sourced among the faculty. On August 25, 2017, Politico published Ambrosino's expose on the hostel, which revealed, among other things, that Granda was the Falwell's business partner. With the media sniffing around, the Fernandez's litigation against Jerry, Becky, and Granda helped reporters piece together more details. That Granda was a 20-year-old pool boy when he met the Falwells, that Granda flew on Liberty's private jet, that Jerry frequented Miami nightclubs, and that Cohen intervened on Jerry's behalf to bury the racy photos of Becky before Jerry endorsed Trump. Liberty employees, newly emboldened, gave accounts to reporters of Jerry's dictatorial leadership style and alleged financial self-dealing, which Falwell strenuously denies. Granda was the biggest loose end, and his relationship with the Falwells was unraveling. Becky suspected Granda was recording their calls to get dirt. He later provided one phone recording to a Reuters reporter. "We didn't think we could trust him," Becky said. Jerry and Becky also believed Granda shared or sold the nude photos because Becky had once texted them to Granda. Granda declined to comment. So why would they keep acting like Granda's friends? Jerry and Becky decided it was best to keep Granda in the fold. "The idea was you keep friends close and your enemies closer," Becky said. In the fall of 2017, Jerry wrote Granda a recommendation letter for Granda's application to Georgetown's real estate master's program. Jerry and Becky were thrilled when Granda got in. He was 27 and seemed to be moving on with his life, independent of the Falwells. When Granda drove from Miami to Washington, D.C. in late August 2018, Jerry even offered to let Granda, his mom, and his sister stay on the farm to break up the trip. Jerry and Becky hoped it would be a chance to wish Granda goodbye. But according to Jerry and Becky, the visit took a harrowing turn. The morning after Granda and his family arrived at the farm, Becky said Granda texted her that the Wi-Fi in the guest house wasn't working. Becky said moments later she found Granda in her daughter Caroline's bedroom. He explained he wanted to stay there because there was internet service. Becky said the next thing she knew, Granda pushed her onto the bed. They hadn't slept together since 2014, she said, and she didn't want to start again. "He said he wanted to have sex, and I said, no, no, no," Becky recalled. Jerry was in the shower down the hall and couldn't hear what was happening. Becky said Granda kept pressuring her. "I kept saying no, I didn't want to do it. But I was scared to death of him, too, because he was still holding everything over me. So we had sex." Becky said it was over quickly. "He left, and I went into the room and just cried." Granda declined to comment. Becky said she didn't report the traumatic experience at the time because she felt guilty about the affair. In her mind, she deserved it. A few months later, Becky told Jerry and two lawyers about the incident. Becky said it also took her time to process that what happened could have been a form of assault. "I said no. Just because we had sex before does not mean he has a free ticket to my body." Granda and the Falwells hurtled toward a blow-up. Months later, a lawyer representing Granda wrote a letter to Jerry's attorney that stated Granda wanted Jerry to buy him out of the hostel for $2 million. $1.1 million in cash, and $50,000 a year for 20 years, according to a letter Granda's lawyer sent on October 15, 2019. Jerry refused. Granda's attorney, Aaron Resnick, did not respond to a request for comment. Granda's emotional state deteriorated, and he talked about suicide. Becky shared a text Granda sent around this time. "My life is absolutely ruined. When they find my lifeless body hanging in the woods, please make sure my dog Logan is returned to my family. Goodbye." In June 2020, Granda and Jerry reached the point of no return. "Since you're okay with ruining my life, I'm going to take the kamikaze route," Granda texted Jerry. According to Jerry, Granda said he would tell people Jerry participated in the affair. "Revenge is coming soon. I'm taking everyone down with me with my side of the story," Granda texted. Becky worried Granda could release clips of the sex tapes she said she had shared with him. "You should by now understand that I will not be extorted," Jerry texted back. "I have always treated you fairly and been restrained in response to your threats because I did not wish to ruin your life. Going forward, stop contacting me and my family." With Granda threatening to go kamikaze, you would think Jerry would have kept a low profile. Instead, he spent 2020 brazenly courting controversy as if he were trying to get fired. The year began with Jerry holding a bizarre press conference calling for rural portions of Virginia to secede and join West Virginia. In March, he tweeted a conspiracy theory that COVID-19 might be a North Korean bioweapon. When campuses across the country went into lockdown and sent students home that spring, Jerry kept Liberty open. But that was just a warm-up. 2 days after George Floyd's murder on Memorial Day, Jerry tweeted a photo of a face mask he printed with a racist photo from Virginia Governor Ralph Northam's medical school yearbook. It showed people posing in blackface and a KKK hood. Jerry tweeted he would only wear a mask that had Governor Blackface on it. Protests and violence erupted in Lynchburg, a city with a large black population. Jerry refused to apologize, even after Black Liberty staffers, including the head of diversity retention, as well as top football and basketball players, quit the school in protest. After nearly 2 weeks of chaos, Jerry grudgingly deleted the tweet. But Jerry couldn't break his destructive social media habit. On Sunday morning, August 2nd, Jerry was relaxing with Becky and Caroline at the farm when he announced he had posted a photo on Instagram and held the phone up. So much was wrong about the picture. Jerry had his pants unzipped and what looked like a rum and coke in one hand, with his other arm wrapped around a pregnant woman with her shorts unzipped and stomach showing. Becky and Caroline were mortified. "We were like, that's terrible, take it down," Becky recalled. Jerry didn't see the big deal. The photo was taken during a costume party aboard billionaire Rick Hendrick's 160-foot yacht. He was dressed as the main character Julian from the Canadian sitcom Trailer Park Boys. The drink in his hand was the BLK brand mineral water he ordered off Amazon, and the woman was Becky's assistant. Jerry deleted the photo, but it was too late. Someone had taken a screenshot, and the media was all over the controversy. On August 7th, the Liberty Board of Trustees put Jerry on indefinite leave. Jerry said he wanted to fight the decision, but didn't have the energy. Since that July, he had been suffering from shortness of breath, dizzy spells, and slurred speech. He said he was eventually diagnosed with pulmonary emboli, a form of blood clots in the lungs. He was hospitalized when his blood oxygen fell to 77%. "The lungs were blocked up with clots. The pressure in the right side of my heart was triple what it should have been, and it was swollen. I barely made it to the car when we went to the hospital," Jerry said. Jerry said he was in a diminished state when a Reuters reporter named Aram Rostin emailed to say Granda had given an on-the-record interview. Granda was alleging Jerry liked to watch Granda and Becky have sex. Did Jerry have a comment? Borrowing a page from Trump's playbook, Jerry wanted to preempt Granda's story with one of his own, but he was too weak to go on television. On August 23rd, he sent a statement to the Washington Examiner. It acknowledged Granda and Becky's affair, but claimed Granda fabricated wild accusations about Jerry's involvement as part of an extortion plot. Before publication, Jerry and Becky sat their kids down. "We never told them until the day before it was about to hit," Jerry, or rather Becky, recalled. "I didn't want my kids to know. You know, how embarrassing is that?" A day later, Jerry says a member of Liberty's board called Jerry and said if he didn't step down, he would be fired. Jerry resigned. Since his resignation, Jerry has been locked in a bitter feud with Liberty. The board fired Jerry's son, Trey, and barred Jerry and Becky from setting foot on campus, even though their daughter is a senior and Jerry's parents are buried there. 2 days after Jerry's resignation, an anonymous former Liberty student and friend of Trey's told Politico that Becky had performed oral sex on him at the Falwells' home in 2008 when he was 22. Becky denied the allegation to me, calling it so ridiculous. In April 2021, the board sued Jerry for $40 million to claw back his eight-figure severance package. The trustees said Jerry committed fraud when he negotiated a lucrative new contract in 2019 without telling the university he was being extorted by Granda. Information the trustees said they were entitled to before they renewed Jerry's multimillion dollar deal. The lawsuit included accounts of Jerry and Becky's booze-filled nights in Miami clubs and alleged Jerry showed up at Liberty when he smelled of alcohol. Jerry and Becky denied the allegations. "The lawsuit was my worst day," Becky said. "I just remember crying all day long. It was our own people coming after us." Jerry said the board held him to an unfair standard. Jerry's reasoning is that he was a university president, not a pastor. His brother, Jonathan, who preached every Sunday at their father's church, was the pious one. Liberty never had any rules for whether the president or any staff member could drink alcohol, Jerry said, sounding like the lawyer he was trained to be. I told him the argument sounded like an extreme case of rationalization, given that he was the leader of a school that fines female students for wearing a dress more than 2 inches above the knee. But Jerry said the current leadership has also broken rules and that some school leaders drank alcohol. "I couldn't believe the board was shocked about that," Jerry said. "The suit is ongoing." Getting rid of Jerry didn't stanch Liberty's image crisis. In August, 12 women filed a federal class action lawsuit alleging the university violated Title IX law by discriminating against women who made allegations of sexual assault and harassment. According to the suit, which is proceeding, Liberty staff discouraged victims from reporting abuse and fined some for violating Liberty's commitment to biblical principles of purity and abstinence. Jerry's successor, Jerry Prevost, released a statement calling the allegations troubling and added Liberty University will not tolerate Title IX violations, sexual abuse, or sexual assault in any form at any time. In October, Scott Lamb, Liberty's former senior vice president for communications, sued Liberty in federal court, claiming he was fired after raising red flags about the way the university responded to sexual assault allegations. Prevost called Lamb's allegations false in a statement. His suit is in progress. In exile, Jerry and Becky's grievances festered, like Trump's, after his election loss. "It's no accident," Jerry said, "that forces marshaled against him in the heat of the 2020 presidential campaign. He pointed out that Granda was advised by Kurt Bardella, at the time a PR advisor for the anti-Trump Lincoln Project. They wanted to get Jerry out of the picture for the election cycle because he got credited for bringing all the evangelicals around, Becky said. Jerry also suspected that Franklin Graham, son of the late Billy Graham, used the scandal to expand the Graham family's influence over Liberty. Franklin Graham's son, Will, was named vice chairman of Liberty's board. Prevost is also a Graham ally. Jerry said Franklin Graham had also once told him that he wanted to start a Billy Graham university, but it didn't get off the ground. In September 2020, Jerry and Franklin got into an argument over who should get credit for Liberty's success. I said, "My dad built the foundation, but I built the house." And Franklin got furious. He said, "You didn't build it." You should have heard the jealousy in Franklin's voice, Jerry recalled. According to Jerry, Franklin Graham told him his future in the Christian world is over. He said, "You'll never be anything in evangelical circles again." Graham, through a spokesperson, declined to comment. Jerry said that being on the receiving end of evangelicals' moral opprobrium has fundamentally turned him away from the movement. He believes in Christ, he said, but not the church. Nothing in history has done more to turn people away from Christianity than organized religion, he said. The religious elite has got this idea that somehow their sins aren't as bad as everyone else's, Jerry said. Listening to Jerry, it made me think he convinced himself Liberty wasn't the fundamentalist school that it is. He would tell reporters that we don't mind if gay and lesbians come here. I would tell him, "I don't know what you're talking about," recalled Lamb. Still, Jerry was feeling optimistic about the future. Even the Miami Hostel investment, the source of so much of his trouble, was looking up. Shortly after I arrived at the farm, Jerry said he signed a lease for the restaurant Macalina to rent more space from him. What used to be the hostel in Miami is now the number one rated Italian restaurant in Miami, Jerry boasted. Becky, though, has struggled. She said she's battled depression over the past year and gained a significant amount of weight. They're both grateful they still have their marriage. "We're together more than any couple you will ever meet in your life," Becky said, as she sat on a stool at the kitchen island. "He forgave me, and that's what Jesus teaches, forgiveness." As I was getting ready to leave the farm, I asked the Falwells if they ever thought about leaving Lynchburg and moving somewhere more socially liberal, like, say, Miami. "No, we've been here for generations," Jerry said adamantly. On the wall above him, hung a vintage Quaker State Oil sign from his grandfather's gas station. Becky nodded and pointed to the farmland out the window. "I told him I'm not leaving ever. Like, my casket's going to be right over here somewhere." Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Kenneth Branagh, the writer and director of Belfast, on mind reading, movie snacks, and reincarnation as a Jack Russell Terrier. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Eating ice cream in the cinema, watching the trailers with the main film about to start? On what occasion do you lie? When Tottenham Hotspur lose a football match, and I defend it as a wonderful opportunity to learn. Which living person do you most admire? Our local doctor. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My wife and literature. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Vacillation. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Time wasting. What is your greatest extravagance? Red wine from northern Italy. What is your motto? Be early, be cheerful, say thank you. What is your greatest fear? Ignorance. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Doubting Thomas. What is your favorite journey? Home. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Dignity. What do you dislike most about your appearance? No good disliking ourselves. Gives the world an excuse to do the same. Which word or phrase do you most overuse in the current state of knowledge? What is your greatest regret? Ever having regrets. When and where were you happiest? Here? Now? Which talent would you most like to have? Mind reading. What is your current state of mind? Exercised. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? Overthinking. Which living person do you most despise? I despise no one. Waste of energy. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? Make it massively bigger. My family, that is. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Decades of friendships. What is your most treasured possession? A sense of humor. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Lovelessness. Where would you like to live? Anywhere happy. What is your favorite occupation? Reading. What is your most marked characteristic? Restlessness. What do you most value in your friends? Laughter. Who are your favorite writers? Shakespeare, Thomas Hardy, Emily Dickinson. What is it that you most dislike? Violence. How would you like to die? At peace. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? A projectionist? Or a football player? Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Prince Mishkin in Dostoevsky's The Idiot. Who are your heroes in real life? The workers of our British National Health Service. What are your favorite names? Tyrone, Eustacia. If you could choose to come back as a person or thing, what would it be? A happy and healthy Jack Russell Terrier who learns how to cure cancer. And that was the Proust Questionnaire with Kenneth Branagh.
Thank you.
This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.